I'm Eric Johnson, professor, University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Brian Hillenblum, I'm with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center. I'm an associate professor of seafood microbiology.
Okay, and yourself?
I'm Lorinda Latka with the State of Alaska Food Safety and Sanitation Program. Mm-hmm. I'm a section manager for the program.
And my name is Chris Sinito, and I'm a Marine Advisory Program personnel, I guess, from Kodiak at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center. And okay. I'm a seafood technology specialist.
Okay, cool. So could you tell me a little bit about why you're in town?
I'm in town. I'm a specialist in botulism. I've studied it for almost 32 years, and I am here to try to help to evaluate the botulism safety of some of the Native American fermentations, mainly the seal oil fermentation.
Could you talk a little bit about what botulism is for those who are unfamiliar?
Botulism is an illness, an acute illness. It's produced by an organism, Clostridium botulinum. In the Alaska area, there's type E botulism is highly prevalent, the spores in the environment. So it contaminates a number of different foods and commodities, and it'll make its toxin, which is the most poisonous toxin known to humankind. And if it is consumed, it can cause a disease, botulism, which is a disease that affects your cranial nerves, primarily your eyes, and then it descends bilaterally and can affect your respiration. And so there is no antidote for botulism, so the people who contract it need to be on mechanical ventilation, and oftentimes that's for several months. And so it's a very serious disease.
How does one contract botulism?
In Alaska here, it's foodborne, in the sense that the organism will, Clostridium botulinum, will grow in a food commodity and make its poisonous toxin, which is then consumed. It's absorbed, readily absorbed in the small intestine, and will then traverse through the circulation and reach the nerves. It's highly specific for nerves. It's not cytotoxic, and so it causes a very distinct disease compared to other foodborne diseases.
What are some of your reasons for coming during this time?
I was contacted by certain people in Alaska. They are interested in developing a process to make the seal oil fermentation or safer from botulism, and I just took a personal interest in it, having worked in the mainland on different types of Clostridium botulinum. And so my interest is to help keep the product safe, and I've gained a lot of respect for the native Alaskans and some of their traditional foods, and I'm here to help evaluate and validate a process to keep these foods safe.
Who invited you?
A number of people. The main person was a man named Val Crail, who's in Kotzebue. And I have had the privilege of meeting Lorinda and Brian, and so it's been a consortium of people who have invited me, including, I think, one of the Native Americans, Alaskans, that conduct this process and want to keep it a safe process. So it's been a collective invitation, and I've been very fortunate. Lorinda here has arranged for me to see the CDC of Alaska, as well as food agencies and other agencies, to discuss the the issue of botulism in Alaska. It's not as well discussed in the continental United States. So it's mostly my interest and experience that has brought me here.
All right, great. And could you guys tell me a little bit more about the other partners, if you're familiar with them, who are behind this project? Yeah, go ahead.
So I work with the Food Safety and Sanitation Program, and we have the Alaska Food Code, which applies to regulated facilities in Alaska. And in Kotzebue, with Manilik's long-term care facility, they had approached us that they wanted to serve more traditional foods on their menu to their elders because it felt like it really helps them with their health and happiness when they're in long-term care. And our regulations allow foods to be donated to them, like a lot of mammal, meat, moose, fish. But we also have some prohibited foods because of, like seal oil, because of the risk of botulism. But seal oil is really important in the diet. So they wanted to try to find a safe way that they could serve the seal oil to the elders there. We, with the Food Safety and Sanitation Program, decided if they could demonstrate a safe process to us that we would be willing to allow those foods to be served, and really encourage that they collaborate with like Brian here with the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center, because they could help evaluate the process. And that's another reason why Manilik sought out Dr. Johnson, because he's really well known for his testing of botulism. Here in Alaska, we do testing, but it's usually in result of outbreaks of illness. And we don't do a lot of preventative testing to see to help evaluate the safety of the product. So it's usually just in response to illnesses, and our labs don't have that capacity. So we're really excited to have somebody that can maybe enlighten us more into that prevention.
My interest is in helping, as I've said, both validate the process from a safety perspective. For example, what aspects in this process may contribute to the growth of Clostridium botulinum and its formation of toxins, and to try to come up or to develop or to implement minor change or changes in the process that will enhance its safety and prevent foodborne outbreaks from type E botulism.
Have you come to any conclusions, or have you made any discoveries in that direction?
It's similar to other foods in a certain sense, and so there's precedence for this kind of seal oil food. An example is garlic and oil has caused a lot of outbreaks of botulism, where there's a thin layer of water on the bottom where Clostridium botulinum can grow. We've had, I think, very productive interactions in the seminars and also in discussions among ourselves about strategies to evaluate this process without making radical changes, to understand both how the toxin may be made in this product and how to control the formation of toxin. At this stage, we're evaluating critically the process. Brian is an expert in HACCP, and Lorinda, she's an expert in safety aspects from a regulatory perspective, is my understanding. And so, but I run an experimental lab, a very high security lab at the University of Wisconsin. And as I've said, my lab's worked on botulism collectively for over 100 years when you consider my lab personnel. So the initial test will be to, I guess, test the formation of toxin during the seal oil rendering process and try to understand the time temperature and the environment that may promote the formation of botulinum toxin.
Okay, so what's your overall goal with your involvement?
My overall goal at this time is to understand the process. I will be going to Kotzebue to talk to elders and people that produce this product to gain an understanding and to work with my colleagues here and to potentially conduct tests in my own laboratory, which is a certified select agent, high security lab, to do a quantitative analysis of the time, temperature, and compositional factors that impact the formation of botulinum toxin in this COL product.
What's the timeline behind the project? Like, when did you contact Dr. Johnson? And basically, when did you contact him?
Dr. Johnson was actually contacted by Menelik Health Corporation at the long-term care facility in Kotzebue. And they wanted to start exploring the possibilities of what it would take to have a product that our department would see as being safe. I think we're just starting to really explore those steps. They're sharing with us their processes for how they hunt the seals and process them and render the seal oil. And we're looking at that from an environmental health perspective and then also from the laboratory. And I think that maybe, I'm looking at Brian, but maybe in the next year or so, we might have some good data so that we could do, you know, like some time temperature studies. Because certainly things are going right. Because people are eating, it's like the butter and condiment of Alaska, seal oil. And so that it's being consumed every day and being prepared safely, but sometimes things go wrong and we've had illnesses. So we want to take our time and make a good decision so that it could be included on the menu at a long-term care facility. And maybe even into the future, people are hoping that it could be on the menu at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage or at other, you know, in Head Starts and adult residential facilities where people can have more of their traditional foods. But maybe over the next year, we've been working on this project for a little over a year and started a kind of ad hoc seal oil task force to look at these issues.
And what's Kodiak's direct association with this?
Primarily, we're the only research facility that deals with seafood. We have laboratories that allow us to actually do what Dr. Johnson will be studying. We're not allowed to do toxin analysis because, as you mentioned, you have to have a high level of biosafety and be registered so that you're able to work with the toxin. But we can work on the other aspects of the seal oil. What is it composed of? For example, the issue about water, how much water is left in the extract, because that will give us an idea when things go bad, maybe that's because some of that seal oil has some residual water available, and that's where we theorize where Clostridium botulinum is actually going to operate. So if they're rendering the oil and the oil is going to float on top of the water, if they're in their process, and it's not very detailed, that's why Dr. Johnson is going to go and, you know, eyeball the process, and maybe we'll go up there later in the year, just to see how they physically manipulate the process so that they, you know, a very simple process, you know, they're just rendering, just letting that sit in a container and stirring it every once in a while. Oil floats and they pour it off. So if they can pour off 100% oil, I would think in theory, then you shouldn't have a botulism incident. But in their mixing, if they're splash over from water or if they're not careful how they're pouring it off, maybe that's the situation because under what we call ambient temperatures, room temperature or outside temperature, that's probably in the range where this organism can proliferate. In fact, with Clostridium botulinum type E, it's the one that can grow at the lowest minimum temperature of all the serotypes, which is 38 degrees Fahrenheit.
And what facilities on Kodiak are working with you guys?
Just us. We became involved, I think, at the end of December of last year, because the Manila organization contacted DEC, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and then they said, well, who do they contact for in the state to find out who knows something about seafood processing and the risks of botulism? And so they contacted us, and we became involved. And so we've been having, I don't know, kind of quarterly teleconferences to try to sort out some of the details, glean some more information, because what we do know from the Alaska Native culture is that a lot of the information is not, it's not a written language, so it's orally translated. And we don't know all the particulars of it. We can't, for example, research it unless we have a collaboration and we can talk about and visually experience what the process is. And then from our vantage point as food scientists and food microbiologists, we know something about Clostridium botulinum and how it acts and how it behaves, and where it can be found, and how do you test for it, and how do you assay for the taxon. And so we can combine those two worlds of traditional knowledge and Western science, we might actually come to the point of, oh, now we know how we can most likely guarantee, hopefully, that there won't be a botulism incident if they follow these particular steps. But the key point in this whole operation is that we needed to contact somebody who works with botulism. And there's very few people in this country who can do that. And Dr. Johnson, who I've never met before, but I've read quite a bit about him, is the authority, a working research authority who can contribute his time and expertise. We can't go to a regulatory agency because they're not going to really do research. Their mission is to ensure safety and validate what happens in an outbreak. So there's very few places you can do this kind of work. And we're very fortunate that he accepted the invitation to come to Alaska. It's his first time, and first time in Kodiak.
Could someone speak a little bit more about the traditional processing?
Yeah, you know, the hunter goes out, depending if it's a summer harvest or a fall, winter harvest. They kill the animal, bring it to shore, and then they process it by removing the meat and the blubber. And so the meat is hung and dried to make dried meat, which is very nutritious, as Lorinda was talking, very important from a subsistence nature. I mean, there's not that many stores, but you have a store outside your door, as the saying has gone. So there's the protein. But then the blubber is sliced into thin strips. It's put into a container, such as a bucket, and it's allowed to the oil emerges from the blubber. And we're speculating that at ambient temperature, it's an oil. It's not like butter, which is solid at room temperature. But as an oil, it gets us, somehow, we don't know what the exact molecular mechanism is, but we think it gets, it exudes from the tissue. And so then there's stirring that goes on over a period of a couple of days, the oil separates, and then that oil is poured off, and some of the particles that might be adhering to it are caught by something called cheesecloth. It's just a mesh. And that oil is collected, and then it's bottled, put into a bottle, and frozen. After the meat has been dried, a lot of times they will put a chunk of this meat into the oil as a flavoring agent, as an additive to the product. So it's essentially meat and oil, which is kind of analogous to what Dr. Johnson was mentioning about putting garlic in oil to make a dressing. This is kind of an equivalent kind of situation.
And so does the botulism sneak in through the water?
Well, that's the point what we're trying to figure out. You know, we're dealing with a recently deceased animal, and we know that Clostridium botulinum in the environment, it's one of the few organisms, well, a group of organisms that produces a resistant body called a spore. So this is something that can survive very extreme conditions. Low nutrients, radiation. It can survive thermal processing. It survives under various ranges of pH. And so these spores are in sediment, the marine sediment, and there's a lot of research papers in the past that have shown that you can go just about anywhere in the world and find these spores. So now the question is, during the harvesting and the butchering process, does the Clostridium botulinum organism get transferred physically by the action of processing the product? So that's the question we don't know in this situation. So hopefully Eric will be able to, at some point in the future, take some discrete samples, possibly if we're going to look at it from an environmental perspective, to see how it gets to what we're looking at this point, seal oil. But as we know, this organism can contaminate a variety of other things that might be existing along with the meat. But the meat itself, as it's being dried, it gets to a very low water content, so it doesn't allow this particular organism, and I should say this organism exists, functions only under anaerobic conditions where there's the exclusion of oxygen. So the concern with seal oil is that you have a process where a lot of the liquid fraction could become anaerobic. So now you're favoring Clostridium botulinum. But if you remove the water factor, you've taken away the ability of this organism to grow. It could be anaerobic, but it's not going to grow because what you have is essentially a pure oil medium. And as we know from central dogma of microbiology, is that microorganisms need water. That's so they can allow nutrients to pass through their cellular membrane. If they don't have water, they're just gonna hang out and wait for better times.
Is there a way to remove the water from the substance?
Chris, you can talk about the ways of processing oils, fish oils and marine oils.
There probably is, but they're very sensitive to the traditional process, and they've asked us, we've kind of hinted at some possibilities that would modernize the process, but they're very adamant on keeping their traditions alive, and they've done it this way for, eons. But so when we do observe their process, we're going to kind of just stand back and watch and observe and see what we can pick up on what might be the dangerous areas. But there are, from my understanding, some commercial seal oil operations in Canada that use modern equipment and, sterilization temperatures and those types of things. So, but this is definitely, we're sticking to tradition in this process. So
the simple thing would have been, let's just take the oil, put it into a can, put it through a retort. It's commercially sterile, it kills the Clostridium botulinum, and the problem, from a Western perspective, but we don't want to go that direction because we want to maintain what the traditional process is. And we know it's not botulism every day. It comes up every once in a while. In fact, what we're talking about, the most recent one that we know of that's documented was back in December 2014. And that's when 25 people in Southwest Alaska came down with botulism from a community-produced seal oil. We don't know the particulars on how that oil was produced because there's no written instructions or there's none of that material is available so that we can actually study it or test it. So that puts us in a kind of a situation where what can we try to do with maintaining the traditional methods and maybe just looking at that and keeping our eye on, we know what it takes to keep Clostridium botulinum away from the oil fraction, because the organism probably doesn't operate in that oily mix. But it probably, if we look for it, it might be in that watery fraction that's below. So my question, of course, would be, what are they doing with that material? I don't think there's any record of what they do with the expressed material, but that might give us a clue and also would confirm if the organism is found, where is it going to be found? We should find it there if it is present. We're not saying it's there all the time. It could be sporadic. There could be geographic differences. We also know each traditional process can vary. Some people want to do just the straight rendering process where there's no fermentation going on, the native fermentation. Some will try to ferment that. And then others in Southeast Alaska will actually put the material in a pot on a stove, cook it, and that really speeds up the process of separating oil from water. Because now as you're cooking, you're breaking down the tissue and makes it very easy to not only express the oil, but also you're probably killing off a lot of bacteria, not necessarily the spores, but there might be some vegetative Clostridium botulinum that might be occurring. So each process is going to have to be evaluated individually. I don't think even two traditional native processes are going to be the same. You know, the North Slope might be different from Kotzebue, and Kotzebue would be different from Quinnahock, and Quinnahock would be different from Sitka. So this is great that the group in Kotzebue wants to do the right thing and find a safe process, and we're here to help.
The state that the foods are in, they can be kind of, do they have to be bottled, or I mean, is botulism a threat just if they're just like?
No, not is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, if it's exposed to air, it technically botulism spores would not.
They wouldn't function.
Wouldn't function,
because
yeah.
What you're looking for is the spore that germinate produces a vegetative cell, and during that process, toxin is being synthesized and developed. So aerobic products, well, there's no threat to that. Vacuum packaged products, present a risk, as we know, and we know that commercial processors have to attain a certain amount of salt level in the product to inhibit Clostridium botulinum in the vacuum packaged product. And that's one way of preserving foods and ensuring food safety. Another would be when we pickle products, we bring the pH down so it's in the acid range, and if it's at a certain level, Clostridium botulinum doesn't grow. Even if it's a fully watery liquid product that's anaerobic, we think, oh yeah, Clostridium botulinum could grow, but nope, guess what? Here's another stop sign. pH is a control. So we have that, we have salt. We also, if you make a dried product and you remove the water, make the water less available, that's a third way of preserving food. So then when you see people making dried, like jerky products and things, very rarely, or it's really impossible to have a Clostridium botulinum incident. In that product, if it's dried enough and it's vacuum packaged, it's because you want to keep it from getting oxidized and off flavors, you're not going to have a problem. So these are very basic food preservation techniques, and people have used them through the ages. And now, of course, companies have commercialized the process. But again, every once in a while, a company will slip up and they have to have a recall, and you'll hear about these kinds of things.
I was going to point, sometimes just the technology changes, you know. Certainly with Alaska traditional foods, the technology changed. You know, we went from where the foods were maybe being fermented or aged, like maybe in grass baskets, and they moved to plastic pails and put lids on them and created an anaerobic environment. I would say for other people and consumers, it's like vacuum packaging. You know, you can go and buy your own vacuum packager. Mm-hmm. People can smoke their fish and vacuum package it. And people, when vacuum packaging came out, they used to think if you could keep it at room temperature, you know, and that was creating conditions where people could make themselves ill. And two, like home canning. If you don't do it safely and you don't follow safe processes, you're running the risk of botulism there too.
And move. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say in the canned foods or thermally processed foods are designed with that organism in mind, that they apply enough heat to destroy that organism, forgetting about everything else. But CBOT is where the cook schedules are designed to destroy. So that's the great fear in canned foods, you know. So, and that's why there's a very detailed heat schedule that canned foods adhere to.
Well, thank you guys so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kayla. Mm-hmm.